Welcome to the Green Alliance podcast. We're the charity and think tank that's all about achieving ambitious leadership for the environment. I'm Dustin Benton, Policy Director here at Green Alliance. How we grow food and feed ourselves while restoring nature and keeping our climate livable is one of the most underappreciated challenges of the decade. Since the Second World War, farming has been synonymous with growing as much food as possible. It's been so successful that people in the wealthy world now suffer the diseases of overabundance, including obesity, diabetes, and high blood pressure. So now we need the land to provide not just food, but restored habitats, carbon removal, wood for construction, and land that soaks up floodwater and stores it through droughts. In short, we need more than one type of farmer. Green Alliance's most recent report, called Land of Opportunity, explores how we get everything we want from the land, including good livelihoods for farmers. It shows how paying for nature restoration on marginal farmland could raise farm incomes, radically reduce carbon emissions, and increase bird populations by half. And it shows how we could make much more space for nature-friendly farming everywhere in the country. Key to this is to rethink what farming is about. To explore this, I'm joined by Helen Browning from the Soil Association, who will talk about agroecology, organic and regenerative farming, and what these traditions can do to help build a nature-positive, carbon-negative food system.
Any politician now, if they don't get this stuff right, it's going to be on their watch. It is their job, their primary job now, to do the things that we need, to provide that real leadership that we need in order to make sure that we've got a planet that's fit to live on in 10 or 20 years' time.
Helen, thanks so much for joining us here. I want to kick off by asking a question I think most of our listeners will have wondered about, and that is, what's the difference between organic, agroecology, and regenerative farming? These are three terms that get bandied about in a kind of different or sometimes better farming kind of sense. Could you kick us off by telling us a bit about how you see them?
Well, I think regenerative is the word that is most loosely defined at the moment. And it's around a set of principles about looking after the soil that tends to be about keeping the soil covered, minimal tillage, bringing animals back into the rotation. So it's a very soil-focused approach and seems to have got enormous traction with people. It's a term that I think feels quite kind of, you know, optimistic and positive, like we can do something about this. So it's really caught on as a term, but it isn't. Apart from those kind of principles, about five principles, it's not clearly defined by way of standards or anything else. Agroecology is a sort of broader term that is trying to help people sort of farm with nature. Again, there aren't standards for agroecology, and it tends to encompass more of a social dimension as well as a sort of technical how you do the farming dimension. It's a sort of broad pathway that is about a direction of travel, as we see it, towards farming with far less inputs, farming in a way that is socially responsible and progressively looking after nature better. So both of those are slightly loose terms in many ways, whereas organic is really clearly defined. You've got an EU regulation, an international standard for organic farming. So you are either an organic farmer or you're not an organic farmer. You have to be certified in order to be able to use that term. It's far more clear what organic is about. People trade on that. You've got a consumer recognition of what organic is, and you've got a clear set of standards to which people have to adhere. But I think one of the reasons the Soil Association has got behind this sort of transition to agroecology is that we need a really broad movement of change in farming and food. And what we need to ensure is that we don't end up with people feeling this is a club that we're either in or out of, but we want people to feel that wherever they're starting from, they can come with us towards a better farming and food future. And agroecology, being a slightly looser term, gives that opportunity for people to get on the bus wherever they are and to make the progress that's right for them without necessarily going organic and having to be in that particular market.
They're pretty consistent with each other, certainly agroecology and organic. I mean, they share, if I've understood it rightly, the principle of perhaps no inputs or at least as minimal inputs, particularly synthetic inputs, as you can possibly get. Could you just draw out a little bit about what you mean by the social character of agroecology? Because that's not something, as I understand it, that's defined within the organic standard. And similarly, my understanding of regenerative agriculture is that it isn't particularly focused on anything outside of the field, as it were.
Yes, exactly. I think regenerative is very much about the way you produce food, the way you're looking after the soil. Agroecology, I think, is looking very much at a fair food system, at the social engagement in farming, in making sure that we're feeding people healthy diets. Organic really doesn't have standards around those kind of things. There have been, we at the Soil Association ran an ethical trade standard for a period of time, for instance, and I think there are things like Fair for Life, which are helpful sort of bolt-ons to organic. But I think agroecology has that sense at its heart that it is about that fairness in the food system.
And it's really interesting that you've mentioned diet right up front. That's an issue I want to come back to. But before we do that, I want to come on to whether or not these three traditions, organic, agroecological, and regenerative, have a shared critique of conventional farming. And let me give you a little bit of primer here on this, because I think it's probably fair to say, prior to the Green Revolution, i.e. the kind of period in the 40s or 50s when agriculture broadly started to apply the then very modernist type of science to increasing yields, started to use synthetic inputs, and, you know, kind of followed that whole thing, massively increased the supply of food that was available. That was seen as a kind of, you know, very 20th century throw technology at the problem and it will save us type thing. It's easy to caricature the three movements I've just discussed as standing in opposition to that. So, you know, let's not use technology or let's not apply technology. But I was really interested to read recently a report from the Soil Association about agro-eco technology. And that seemed to me to be an attempt to kind of say, no, we do like technology, but maybe not the same technologies that conventional agriculture uses. So I wonder if you could explain what types of technologies you see as useful and why you don't think that the types of technologies that have been applied to conventional farming are the ones that you see as helpful.
Well, when we commissioned that report, we were very interested in the question, how can technology help us in that move to agroecological food and farming systems? So what technologies and what conditions will help a more nature-friendly farming and food system thrive? And I think looking at it through that prism, there are clearly technology has already impacted on organic farms and on lots of agroecological and regenerative farms. Technology plays an enormously important role. I think in the past, we've tended to look at inputs, often synthetic inputs, which are usually counterproductive in terms of the ability of other species to thrive. They're usually killing things. Whereas I think that a lot of the engineering technologies coming through, for instance, can be extremely helpful. And just to give you one example, on my own farm here, we are now starting to experiment with drilling our cereal crops into a clover mulch, into a clover lay. So instead of having to plough or to use glyphosate, we now have the engineering solutions that allow us to put the crop into the grass, into that clover, so that it's fed with nitrogen from the clover plant. You don't get the weeds growing up. And we can do that because of the equipment, but also because of GPS and RTK tracking, which allows us to very precisely grow those crops and control the weeds within them without having to use chemicals or without having to plough. So I think it's thinking about what are the technologies that will help us. And we found a lot of them within that report, as you'll have seen.
One of the things you described was, you know, GPS and essentially engineering solutions to, I mean, the picture you have painted in my mind is one that sounds glorious. You don't have to kill the clover. You can drill directly in. Presumably the clover stays alive as the crop is growing, which is a very different perspective from some of the conventional agriculture. I was surprised to see in preparing for this that there are some types of indoor glasshouses where they attempt to entirely sterilize the soil and the glasshouse prior to growing. And the idea is, you know, kill absolutely everything and then only allow those things to live that you've put in there. And it's a very different kind of perspective, what you're saying, keep lots of things alive. But is there a tension here? In a certain sense, farming is about getting rid of the things that we can't eat in a particular place, such that the things that we can eat grow more. And secondly, insofar as these technologies have high costs, is there a tension between the agroecological drive to allow everyone to be able to become a farmer very easily and the very high capital costs that might be involved in getting in those precision drilling techniques, perhaps small farm robots, all the kind of cool technologies that we might think are great for nature and great for farming, but might mean a big barrier for farmers that want to come into the business?
Firstly, the holy grail of our farming systems is not having to kill everything else in order to produce our food. That is the way we've done it. There has been a trade-off between biodiversity and productivity in farming. I think what we're seeking within our agroecological solutions is to have that diversity of plants and sometimes animals within the system, that sort of multifunctionality, which allows much more to thrive without that need to kind of get rid of one in order to achieve the other. And if those things are a mixture of your clovers and nitrogen-fixing plants, which are great for your insects, if you can maintain that within your crop, you've got a real win-win. So I think that what we need to seek to do is to move into that mindset where we understand the multifunctionality of land, where we think about how we can encourage its bounty without having to wipe out everything in order to achieve that.
Isn't there a bit of a trade-off? I mean, I want to be honest. If you look at, for example, organic yields, they're a bit lower than conventional yields. And so if you're keeping lots of species alive in the farm, is there not a, I mean, they've got to eat something, right? So they, it's not a kind of, we can just get everything, you know, all the vibrancy of nature back on the farm, keep our yields really high. And it was just a stupid modernist dream that led us down this false hope of conventional agriculture.
Wherever you're farming, you're going to be disrupting nature to a degree. So you're right, of course, there is always a trade-off between biodiversity and food production. It's about trying to minimise that trade-off and to think about how can we, for instance, grow a multiple of different crops in the same field in a way that actually gives lots more opportunity to for both yield, because we know when you combine crops, you get overall a bigger harvest. The problem has been in the past, how do you then separate those crops out after harvest to be able to put them into the component parts that you need? So we're working with people, for instance, who are growing mixtures of things like peas, oilseed rape and barley in the same field. Now, that would have been unthought of, you know, 20 years ago.
And just to cut in here, the reason why it was unthought of is because the machines that were used to grow food in the 70s, 80s, 90s couldn't separate that out those crops. So it was the technology that forced us to do monocultures. Is that the critique?
So you do need good seed separation kit if you're going to then, obviously, if you're going to use the whole of that crop to feed animals or something, then you don't maybe not need to separate it out. But if you're growing oilseed rape, which is a very, very small seed alongside peas, which are a very, very big seed, you need to be able to have a seed separator that can take those components apart after harvest. But growing them together gives you a huge amount of benefit, both for biodiversity, but also for yield.
Does the state help you out with that? So if I'm thinking about the kind of technology you need to separate seeds, or perhaps the practice, the practical knowledge that's required to do that kind of intercropping, are you, as a farmer yourself, or the farmers that you represent in the Soil Association, getting support from the state through, say, Rothamsted Research or CEH or any of the other kind of big agricultural bodies to do this stuff?
Not directly. That's why we started our own research program, Innovative Farmers, which is about giving groups of farmers small grants to be able to take on board those kind of that sort of, do that sort of trialing themselves. It's a very cost effective way of getting on farm research, applied research done. And we do get support from people like Rothamsted and some and many of the other research institutes in terms of people coming in to actually make sure the trial design is correctly done so that we can get decent data out at the other end. So they're supportive of the approach. They're not necessarily funding the work that's being funded philanthropically.
Really? So the state isn't helping to deliver this agroecological or regenerative or organic future you're describing?
No, there may be some research projects that are being established in the institutes that are doing some of that work, although they're far fewer than they should be. But in terms of applied on-farm work, we've been calling for it for years. One of the challenges we've had over the last few decades is most of the research funding, particularly that privately funded, has gone into what they call wealth-creating products rather than into the knowledge that farmers need to be able to do things differently and better. And it's knowledge we're short of, really. How do we actually get these right combinations to work? What's going to be most successful? Actually being able to do decent trials work on this kind of stuff. We can see it working. We've got some great progressive farmers who are just getting out there and doing it, and we're trying to support them where we can. But we need a hell of a lot more.
You're describing here what I have heard called knowledge intensive rather than necessarily capital intensive. It's quite a shift in how we think about how farm funding works. I mean, I'm familiar with the story of the UK's agricultural colleges being kind of cut back, and I think it was the 90s, perhaps even in the 80s. And quite a lot of the complaints I've heard from farmers who have parted ways with the conventional way of doing things is they say basically all the money's gone into the tractors and into the inputs and none into the farmer themselves. So in a sense, is that part of the social goal of agroecology to put some money, time, effort, knowledge back into the farmer themselves?
Very much so. We want farmers in the lead here. We talk about farmer-led research, actually doing the work that they need done in their specific circumstances. It's also a great way of getting knowledge transfer, because if you get a bunch of farmers to define the problem that they're seeking to solve, then you can actually input, well, this is what we know about the state of the art so far. Now, what do you need to know further to that? And I think we can have a real revolution in terms of how farming is done and how quickly we can move forward in the right direction if farmers are much more in that driving seat.
You've talked about the farming community, you've talked about farmers. My question is, what is a farmer? And the reason I ask is that I see all over a lazy caricature of what a farmer is, and that is a person who tills a field in order to maximize yield. You know, the goal is produce as much food as you possibly can from your land. And I have to say, I have always felt a little bit of frustration about that, because not all land is the same. And I'm not totally sure that farmers are just kind of robots seeking to maximize yield in all cases. Now, the Soil Association hasn't been an organization that is typically focused on belting out the yields. That's been the conventional agriculture. And I wonder if you could give me a bit of a sense of what you're seeking to do differently, and perhaps to touch on another thing that you mentioned earlier, diversity in the farming system, and perhaps describe some of the benefits of that for our listeners.
I think farmers have had this conception of themselves exactly as you have described, that their job is to feed the world. We've been told from the day we're born that our job is to feed the world and to go out there and maximise yield. But I think one of the reasons I've enjoyed working so much in the organic movement over my lifetime is that you've got a whole bunch of men and women there who see it very differently, who are trying to optimize against a number of objectives, see themselves as land managers rather than just about producing a crop, trying to actually make space for nature, do things in a socially responsible way. And I think that progressive farmers today are very much in that place. You're starting to see farmers boasting on Twitter now about the new butterfly that they've found or the amount of soil organic carbon they've got. It's not everybody, but I think that more and more farmers are up for that change. The interest and excitement around regenerative farming, loose term though it is, I think signifies that farmers are really up for moving in a new direction, that they recognise that their soils have run out of steam. They're being sold a lot of inputs that they don't need if they were thinking about things a bit differently. So I do think that there is a real appetite amongst the farming community to shift on now. We're seeing a more diverse farming community. It needs to be far more diverse, but we are seeing more women, for instance, on farms now, playing a full role. I think that's had a big impact again in the organic movement. We've seen a lot of women very, very active in their farming careers and very keen on taking that nature-friendly direction. But the diversity theme is one I think we need to play across everything, from the variety of crops that we grow and the variety of crops that we eat, and our diets and our land would be better if we were diversifying that. It brings resilience to the farm. If you have a number of different crops and you've got a chance that the weather conditions will work for some, even if they don't work for all. And then I think that sort of biodiversity, it's always been seen as a competitive threat, as you've described it, to yield. But actually, I think we're seeing more and more farmers and more work showing that if you have habitats and plenty of wild things on your farm, that they actually can enhance your farming system because you're maintaining the predator insects and you're maintaining that natural balance so that things like aphids don't get out of control. So I think diversity in every regard is part of the resilience story.
I was going to jump in on the diversity point, because one of the questions I wanted to ask, bringing things across to policy, is of course, for a long time, the UK has been in the EU's common agricultural policy, which is
a single system for a very large land area and many hundreds of thousands, perhaps even millions of farmers. England's proposed environmental land management system, the ELM system, which is a replacement for CAP, which purports to be focused more on nature, more on climate. Do you think it's doing enough to support the kind of diversity that you see? And how would you want the environmental land management scheme in England to develop? And are there any lessons that England can learn from Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland, which have different systems, and indeed from the rest of the EU?
Big question. So I think that the opportunity for us to do our own thing on the way we support farming and what we encourage in farming was one of the few things out of Brexit that might have been quite useful. And certainly a lot of effort has gone in from DEFRA to try and get that right. I think we've got lost a little bit of that kind of inspiration that we had right at the outset in terms of health and harmony and, you know, the kind of real setting out the flag for how things are going to be completely different. But I do think that the direction of travel is the right way to go. The public money for public goods mantra, which we've been talking about ever since I was on the Currie Commission in 2001, and trying to actually ensure that the market to some extent looks after itself, but that we put the public money into the right places. I know that things like the SFI, the Sustainable Farming Incentive, and the focus on soils initially in that has been decried by some, but actually I think it's an incredibly important place to start. If we don't get soils right, if we don't safeguard the soils we've got, we're not going to have an agriculture in the longer term. And I think those relatively low payments, but to encourage farmers to start doing the right things, to start monitoring their soils, to start covering their soils, is really helpful. I think we're still slightly vague over the next two tiers and exactly how they're going to look. But I'm excited by the fact that there's been a commitment to obviously an organic farming scheme, but also to an agroforestry scheme. And agroforestry is another of those real win-win opportunities that we've been promoting very heavily at the Soil Association, which I've been experimenting on my farm here, by bringing trees into your farmed environment, using thinking about nuts and fruits and biomass and all those other things that you can take from trees. You've got a real opportunity to square that circle between looking after nature, sequestering more carbon, and maintaining or even increasing yield of food overall. Wales and Scotland seem to be able to move faster and further, but within Europe, the farm to fork strategy, controversial in some areas, but I think their commitment to, for instance, 25% of the land area being organic by 2030, that sort of level of ambition that we just don't have in the UK is something that we should be really taking note of.
It would be quite a big shift if the UK were to go for, say, a 25% organic target.
Yes, and I think it's almost impossible to achieve by 2030. But what we would like to see is the UK government having as much ambition around this as the EU does. In the UK, we've had policymakers forever who've been very sceptical for no real clear reason.
May I just poke at that a little bit? Because the impression I have, and to be clear, I used to be the man from Whitehall who was, you know, in the machinery of government. And so I have some sense of where the scepticism comes from. And I guess quite a bit of it seems to focus on cost. So if you look at the cost of organic food in shops, it's often more expensive. And the perception I have is that that's the thing that makes policymakers think, well, Britain's about cheap food, so therefore we're not so keen on organic.
I think that you're right. I think when you're looking at plant-based systems, particularly as you see input costs rising in the way that they are at the moment, the cost of production on agroecological stroke organic systems, I think, will start to feel quite competitive when you start to look at nitrogen fertilizer, for instance, at the price it is today. So I think where the challenges have been, particularly around horticultural production, has been in labor costs on things like weeding. And again, technology can help us with some of the robotics that are coming through. So I think there's everything to play for there. The other challenges in the organic sphere have been the on-cost beyond the farm gate, the efficiencies of scale, because it's such a small sector, you're having to process it in particular places, transport stuff around more than you would do normally, running small batches, that kind of thing. So there's lots of reasons why I think the cost of the animal side is troublesome, particularly with pigs and poultry, because of the high cost of grain that's coming off the organic farms. So there's, again, if you can solve some of these problems, cost needn't be the barrier that it seemed to be in over time. And certainly that's what we want to see at the Soil Association. We very much want to see organic as available to everybody at prices that are affordable.
Just on that note, the programme that I looked at in the food strategy, which seemed most interesting from that perspective, was the Food for Life programme, which provides food to schools that, I mean, the budget for school food is tiny. And yet there were some really interesting examples of where Food for Life had provided wholly organic food at the same price as conventional. I wonder if you could say a little bit how that actually happens.
The way that you do that largely is about getting uptake, so getting efficiencies of, you know, getting the numbers up in schools so that you're getting, because if the more you're catering for, the more affordable it gets. Often it's the on-cost, the preparation costs that seem to be a huge problem. And then looking at menu design and reducing the amount of meat on the menu while improving the quality of the meat that you do feed people. So actually by looking at the menu, then actually improving the school food to the point where more kids want to eat it, and therefore you get, as Henry Dimbleby found out in the school food plan, you need to get the uptake to get the whole cost efficiency of the system working. So we've done that incredibly successfully. We still serve something like 1.8 million meals a day to Food for Life standards across schools and other settings, also hospitals and other public settings. And it shows that it really can be done. You can transform the feed system. You can actually feed people healthily and well, and you can do that on a budget, but you just need to think hard and commit to doing it.
So there's an element of you've got to have the knowledge, you've got to be quite thoughtful about how you put your menu together. And then, of course, you need to have a bit less meat. But I want to stress it's not a vegetarian or a vegan approach. There is still meat on the menu. It's perhaps just a bit less. I want to wrap up with one final question. And this perhaps is a little bit mean because we talked about policy. We've talked about the kind of challenges that face farmers a bit. And of course, we have the prospect of a new prime minister. In fact, we have the certainty of a new prime minister in just a short while. I was looking at the NFU's assessment of the two candidates, Sunak and Truss, and they rated them on their friendliness to farmers from their perspective. So Rishi got 3 out of 6, 3 green ticks out of 6, and Liz Truss only got 1 tick. What do you think the next Prime Minister's biggest challenge is, and are you worried about their attitude towards farming?
Well, I'm worried about their attitude to not just towards farming, but to the environment at large. I mean, I just haven't seen anything like enough debate around the really big issue that's facing us, climate change, let alone the erosion of nature. It just feels like these are secondary, subsidiary issues for both those politicians and, in fact, seemingly for much of the Tory party. So I think that those issues need to come up the agenda very fast. I mean, we need to be tackling the climate change issue like we tackled COVID. We need to be chucking everything at it we can. We have so little time to get this right. So farming's important, but farming in the context of what we need to deliver for the climate, what we need to deliver for nature, what we need to deliver by way of healthy and sustainable diets. Any politician now, if they don't get this stuff right, it's going to be on their watch. It is their job, their primary job now, to think beyond the very short-term sops they want to give to us all to kind of get them to vote for us, but to do the things that we need to provide that real leadership that we need in order to make sure that we've got a planet that's fit to live on in 10 or 20 years' time.
Well, Helen, from your lips to their ears, thank you very much for taking the time to speak to us. It's been a brilliant conversation. Very good luck to you on agroecology and all things organic.
Thank you very much, Dustin.
Thank you for listening to this Green Alliance podcast. Keep checking in as we continue to bring you specialist interviews and highlights from our events here on your podcast feed. You can subscribe to the Green Alliance podcast on your favourite podcasting app, and you can follow us on Facebook or Twitter at Green Alliance UK. See you next time.